Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated. Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk. A show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jarvis here, and along with me is my co-host, Han. Han, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Jim. Sorry for the hiccup there.
I'm not quite sure what gremlins got into the computer and decided to start the intro music twice, but we'll get through that. Tonight's episode, episode number 8 of Straight Talk, is titled, Can an Equipment Supplier Be My Designer? So we're going to be able to go over any and all aspects having to do with the integration of equipment designer and equipment supplier, and what and how you or we should look at. Obviously, tonight's show, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, you can get us at 657-383-1442. We'd be glad to hear from you, answer your question. And with that, obviously, the equipment supplier is an integral team member. If you go back to our one of our first episodes, we talked about the team building, and your equipment supplier is crucial to one of those core team member elements. And we also know that many of them like to and have discussions about the possibility of designing your office space, whether it's a renovation or new. And again, tonight's topic will cover both aspects of a new construction, a new build, or a renovation of your existing practice. So, Han, I'll let you start off the discussion about the aspects of designing an office, but mostly how to integrate in your equipment supplier.
Well, typically, maybe this is more self-serving, is that I like to have onto the project early on, if possible. Naturally, we're going to need to know what the doctor is going to use in terms of equipment, delivery system, and all that. That information is typically best acquired from the equipment folks. That's an assumption that the doc's going to buy new equipment. The supplier, naturally, they, like Jim say, they are an important member of the team. Their role is very different. So when we say the supplier, you have several candidates that are at the table or potentially at the table, and often the lead individual are usually your sales rep. I myself have not ran into a equipment sales rep that are trained in the area of architecture. They typically are more sales oriented than engineering or architecture. So they can bring to the table the pros and cons and the array of information that pertain to the equipment that's going to go into the building once everything is put in place. Often the discussions of if a space is to be designed by the supplier, the conversation between the owner the person who actually do the design, the brain, you know, the brain behind the design are lack, because they don't, the owner do not have the opportunity to communicate directly with those individuals that are doing the design work. So there's always a loss of information and translations, is that it get hand down to the salespeople, and the salespeople interject their ideas. Good or bad, I think the intention is always good, but often they lack the training, and even though they've been in the field for whatever number of years and they've been involved in whatever number of projects, however, they're involved in the more in the equipment, placement equipment type of equipment than the actual process of designing. So,
Con, are you saying that the sales reps, who obviously are they're out in the field dealing with the doctors, dealing with the people there within your dental practice, are you saying that they typically hand these design elements off to someone back in the home office who would then become the quote designer and create something?
Yeah, I don't want to use this as a broad stroke application to the conversation. Of course, there's always an exception to the rule, but in general, the collecting the information and the actual is usually done by the sales rep. Yes, some of them are more seasoned, more knowledgeable, and may have a little bit more idea of what kind of information to collect. It's not very difficult to measure up a space, okay? So the size of the room, location of the door, that stuff, you can, a high school kid can do that without too much issues. Once the information is sent to the design studio, then it's typically done on a blind. So if there is a question or communication that the doc need to have or with the designer or the designer with the doc, that's usually are pretty rare that they have that one-on-one kind of conversation. There is organization that do sell equipment, but do also do design work, and they probably more integrated. But in general, that is the scenario, Jim, where the salespeople handle everything. I mean, they're the one that it's almost like having a project manager in an engineering firm. The owner of the project get to talk to the project manager, who may be an engineer, who may be an architect, but they're not the one who's doing the actual work. And they may not even be the one who are the brain behind the design. But again, because they're the front person, that's who you get to talk to. And then they just get relayed back and forth, back and forth. So you don't, you lose the continuity and the one-on-one aspect that you can see there. They can explain to you in their term and answer your questions without any miscommunication or any loss in interpretations from the next, from the second or third or fourth tier down or up, mm-hmm. whichever the case is.
How best do you then integrate the equipment supplier into the process so that everything done is done, more in a seamless fashion as opposed to the way that you described?
Well, ideally, at least for the way we work, we sit down, we gather in as much information as possible from the, from the client. We have a good idea of the, of the system that they use and the particular that they're looking for. We lay out the space. Once it's pretty much pinned down, and then we can forward to the, to the equipment people, and then they use our drawings to place the equipment and the support and all that stuff that they need. But that usually is the smoothest transition for us. Of course, everybody wants to own a piece of the action. So, one, it's doing that. Of course, we always try to encourage them to add their two cents or add their, if there's anything that they feel that they can add value to, they should voice it. But often, at least from, my personal experience interacting with equipment people, is that they like to redesign the facility without knowing the conversation, what the doctor really need. Because, of course, again, who doesn't want to add their personal touch to the project? But often it really mucked things up. And then you have to take a few steps back to, again, re-educate, bring the team back into alignment with what had already been discussed, with it, all the pros and cons that have been conveyed and worked out.
Well, that leads to my next question, and I think I know the answer, but it has to do with there are so many functions that need to be looked at. There's so many areas, so many components, so many aspects that need to be looked at when you pull together a design that maybe the sales equipment supplier and his related back home staff are not really trained in doing. Do you want to discuss some of those things that really need to be looked at from day one? Things like, the handicapped accessibility code and so on.
Yeah, I think part of the challenge that I see when you're designing from a distance and you're not trained to look at the entire project from a bird's eye view, rather than simply, like a little gecko on the ceiling looking down. They ignore and don't ask the questions. Is that you got a building, you look at the floor plate, the telltale sign of whether that building is residential, commercial, whether it have different elevation in the floor, on the interior floor. All the things that trigger, that raise the red flag that base require more than simply how many operatory you can throw in, and how many pieces of equipment you can squeeze into the place. And so some of the big issue is you're looking at designing a building from the inside out, which is a great approach. However, when you ignore the exterior and how the surrounding service, what is being designed, I think it's missing the mark greatly. For instance,
you're talking about site orientation, for example. Like we've said before in a previous episode, that operatories are always best if placed on the north elevation of a building because of light and sun and how it would potentially stream into the space through the window. It's best located on the north as opposed to an east or a south or a west window.
Yes. Now, see, I know that from the old school, that is, should be taken into consideration with modern technologies and stuff like that. That can be mitigated. The other things that I'm looking at, besides the orientation, of course, if you are building new, you want to take advantage of the best view possible, with the ideal orientation, so you don't have to, plant more vegetation and trees, and put on awning and solar shades and stuff like that, to offset the glare and the heat buildup on the west side, all that good stuff. Besides that, if the building is designed or a floor plan of a building is laid out without looking at where is the parking for, let's say, for the patient? Where is the parking for the staff? Is it going to be two dedicated spaces for each, or is it going to be combined? Where are the building's going to be serviced? So the parking in relation to where is the staff lounges at and things like that. So, the circulations of services and staff go into the building plays a crucial part on the orientations and the layout of the space. So often you look at a floor plan, you go, I got 10 operatories and I have, the break room and the number of toilet rooms and all that stuff. But if it's not designed properly and to work in conjunction with the site, then you're basically designing in a box. Okay, it's not appropriate, it's not correct, and it creates issues. If you don't know the site, the limitation of the site, it could be an issue with setback. It could be an issue with wetland, and flood, and flood zone and things like that. So an easement, it has to be a design process done comprehensively. Otherwise, you're just getting pieces and parts, and hopefully somebody put all the pieces together. And usually, if the architect is not on the job at the beginning of the project, the architect, he or she, will be the one that gets blessed with all the things, all the pieces and parts, and get to work out all the problems that have not been worked out. By then, again, the layout may have to be redesigned, as we have experienced ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about things like code issues having to do with aspects of life safety, having to do with aspects of fire rating. Let's say you have a retail center and you're taking a space that's in between two other spaces. How was that original facility designed in such a way? Does the demising wall, the wall that separates you from the other tenant, does it have to be rated? Is there a fire rating requirement for your ceiling? You're thinking about structural issues having to do with, it would be perfect if we could knock out this column and place the design with the operatories one after another, for example. But structurally, it maybe is not the right or prudent thing to do because there's an excessive cost to either removing or relocating that column. Those kind of aspects have to be integrated into the design from day one as opposed to after the fact, i.e. requiring that redo that you talked about.
What I find is if a client come and say, I'm looking at this space, I want 3,000 square feet, and here is the demising wall. We can take as much as we want or take as much as we need. Some of the common mistake that I see is the demising wall located smack onto a storefront window. Now, fire rating, as far as I'm aware of, the in condition where the demising wall but a window frame doesn't have a fire rating, as far as I know.
That's correct.
I have
it
not
doesn't.
Run
yeah.
that. Yeah, that have not been a big issue for a lot of municipalities. But if I am the new fire chief in town, that would not happen. Because again, it's life safety and health of the occupant. I take the asset, the physical asset of the building, is secondary to the life that's inside the building. So when a layout are done without the knowledge or consideration for fire rating, I've seen it too often where the wall actually just abut the storefront, not the mullion, but smack in the middle of the glass plate. One, you can't get a fire rating. Two, it's very difficult to do a good job and a clean job of noise isolation between the two spaces. But noise isolation is secondary to fire. Okay? So you need people that are awake to do those design. You need people that should be somewhat knowledgeable and looking at everything that that where you can design out the, you know, remove the problem than to introduce problem. So they're, most of the time, they're not bold enough to say to the client, the proposal of the location of the demising wall hits the window and we recommend that you move it, whether you enlarge the space or move the space down a few feet so that it can terminate into a wall where it's, you know, where it's more ideal. And actually, ideal would not be the right word. I think it would be perfect, because you have a wall that's cleanly terminated into a another wall where it can be finished clean and meet the fire rating requirement. So those are some of the, you know, some of the issues.
Right. I'm thinking back on some of our previous projects, and it just doesn't have to do with retail spaces or centers where you're trying to do a several thousand feet space in the middle of a shopping center. Think about a project that we had, a freestanding building. It was an existing building, and the building itself was actually over the property line. So there were easement issues where the actual building did not sit with the existing building, did not sit on the property that the dentist bought. And so I remember that had to be dealt with, and it revised the initial layout on that particular project. The equipment supplier did create the initial layout. And when we were all said and done, had to be totally redone because that wasn't known. Now, it's not their fault. The equipment supplier didn't know that, but the issue at hand was that it wasn't investigated and it wasn't looked into, so that we didn't spend and waste all of everybody's time creating something that was really unable to be built.
You have to do your due diligence, okay? If you look at a floor plan, you want to make sure that the question is, what's around it? What's the limitation from the exterior, particularly if you're going to add on? So, can you add on in this direction, that direction, or upward? Whatever it is that you do that affects the actual footprint of the building. If you expand the building footprint, there's a couple of things that need to be looked at. Is that zoning, okay? Will it be the expansion encroaching to the setback? If yes, then you can't expand that way. How about parking? How much parking do we need to add because of the addition? So, you know, it has a almost a catastrophic effects if zoning and building codes and all that are not not go through the proper analysis first. You'd be designing from, or the space or the building will be designed from from the blind. In that particular case that you were talking about, the scenario you're talking about, it could have been a disastrous situation where the dog owned the building based on the design. She purchased the building and she could not use the building.
Well, exactly.
And
actually,
and
I believe that one also had some right-of-way issues where the building and the expansions that were anticipated by the layout required variances because of the existing right-of-ways. Again, the equipment supplier did not know about those. So here we are, we have our client, our tenant, you know, our client, our dentist comes to us and says, okay, I'd like to create this design. Here's the preliminary floor plan. Can you take this and make it happen? Well, all of a sudden, there is a pile of issues that can't be resolved short of going through the variance process, which was a lengthy and costly effort. Thankfully, we got it approved and got the local municipality to agree to it and allowed her to move forward, but it effectively cost her time and money. We both know that time and money both are synonymous with each other. You know, loss of time basically means loss of money.
Jim, I do have a question for you, okay? Because this is not just work that are done by the supplier, because from time to time, discussion focus around contractors. You know, our contractor be the right people to design a dentist's office? And often, the answer is perhaps. Okay, I can't say that there, because some contractor do have in-house architects, but most don't. So from an architect's viewpoint, Jim, what can you share in terms of pros and cons in using, as far as the responsibility and the level of training that the architects go through compared to the contractors? Because often I think a lot of the folks I communicate with on a daily basis are under the impression that you don't need an architect. The contractor is the guy who built them. So go talk to your contractor.
Right. Well, actually, you're right. That is a misnomer, an unfortunate misnomer in the business out there. The architect is a needed entity, one of the crucial team members. We've talked about that before. Obviously, you can go back and catch the episode one or two that talks about their team. But from a training standpoint, you want to put the best person in the best position to do what they need to do to help you to move forward for what you're trying to accomplish. The contractor or the project manager and his trade contractors are best at creation of construction. They're trained and have expertise in actually building things. Whereas the architect is best trained through the many years that we have to go through in schooling before we're allowed to get our license. We deal with things like obviously the design, obviously the integration of all the systems and how they work together, and things like spatial relationships, aesthetics. We also deal with the most important part is life safety and code-related issues so that you can actually get a building permit so your contractor can go out there and build the thing. Now, the two roles have kind of grown and evolved a little bit when you get into the world that's called design build, where the contractor actually either hires or has in-house an architect that's part of their team. And, you know, that might work for you. It isn't what we recommend because to this date, I don't know of a design build contractor who has an architect either on staff or that can hire out that has the dental experience necessary to be able to put together a dental office. The design build process was created for back when factories were being produced at a quick process, and they wanted to try to find the quickest possible way to be able to get square footage up when they're trying to put a factory up. So those are big open spaces which aren't as detailed and intricate as a dental office would be. And so we find that it's actually trying to, you know, put a square peg in a round hole to let the contractor be the individual that would design your particular space. Unless, of course, they have an architect on staff and or they hire an architect that really understands dental facilities. But I, to this date, I've not heard of one or been involved with one that really actually was able to do that.
It's of course, you know, of course, there's always the exception to the rule, okay? But yeah, in general, I find that there seems to be a belief that the architects on the job is just an unnecessary evil, and the contractor could get everything done without an architect involved. I have not run into a situation where the contractor sit down at the table, create their own, solve the issue, solve the problem, solve the design problem, and then take that drawing down to, down to the city and get a CO and then do everything. They rely on a lot of people too. So if the, if they are to be the one who come to the table first, I would say somewhere in that process, there's an architect being squeezed for their service for the cheap, and all the decisions are made in the field. There's compromise that are often resulted through that process. Now, I'm not blowing smoke about this. I have been the recipient of the working in that process, and we produce the same amount of work, if not more, and they could pay just as much, if not more, for the work that they do, but the design build somewhere in that process, they still need to have the information. If it's not provided, they'll come up with it, and you as the owner may not get the best quality because it's not written out, it's not specified, it is to be made on the run. And so,
well, it's all
it's
a matter
not
of
a
control.
Process.
Yeah, it's a matter of control. It's where and who do you want to have control over all aspects of your project, and that has to do with the quality, that has to do with the finishes, that has to do with the cost, that has to do with really every aspect of your project. Who do you want to give that control to? Do you want to be in control of it, or do you want to hand it off to a design build construction entity who said, sure, we'll get it to you for X dollars, but you've lost all control over everything else. But you got it for X dollars.
Jim, I didn't want to hijack the program and take it too far off the track in dealing with the contractor. But back to the suppliers, when for us. For us, from a architectural standpoint, we like them to get onto the project, dealing with the design portion toward the end after the space been laid out. However, when they need to be involved in the project, from a team member standpoint, as early as possible, because they need to have the discussion with the owner in terms of what kind of equipment is being planned. Whether to replace and upgrade, so that way the information, the equipment that's being considered, the information for those equipment can be gathered so that the team can verify and dedicated the physical space that's required for those purchases or for
the purchase that are being planned
in the future.
Yeah, I remember one of our designs was based around the dentist's desire to purchase a, 14-foot long, pretty much self-contained sterilization system. That whole set of cabinetry, which had everything necessary for it, was 14 feet long, so feet wide, and we had to create the design around it. It's kind of like that commercial where you used to see where the clients came into an architectural office and dropped down a faucet and say, design me a house around this faucet. Well, it's the exact same way. You need to have your equipment supplier there early so that you can pick and select and choose and say, these are the pieces and parts that I want. And then you say, okay, to us, how do you see these to go together. Well, as long as we know what they are, then we integrate those from day one, as opposed to going through the whole design process and then coming back later and say, oops, we'd like to add this into it. Well, that could throw a major monkey wrench into the whole design and require it to be totally redone. And nobody wants to waste time and energy, because we're businesses. We're trying to get something accomplished as quick and as efficiently as possible, satisfy your needs, and get it to a point where the contractor can get moving and moving forward. But I did want to add one component to what you talked about in regards to the contractor and the architect and so on. Architects are required in every state of the union to be integrated into the project, with the exception of Texas. And as long as you build something under, I believe it's 5,000 feet in Texas, you don't have to have an architectural seal signed by a registered architect in that particular state. But everywhere else in the country, you have to have that. And it's also against the law for us as an architect to take a set of drawings that are created by somebody else and stamp those drawings. That's basically a tantamount, easiest way in the world to lose your license. It's called plan stamping, and it is literally against the law, and easily a registered architect would lose their license. They are required by code and by their licensure to be involved and in total control of the production of the documents and the designs from day one. So that's another aspect of that I wanted to talk about. I do have a question, Han, is when we do our work, of course, and I think I know the answer because we've been doing this together for so many times, but our listeners don't. Do we work with any specific equipment supplier, or how best do you see that happening?
We are, sometimes the equipment people are brought to us because they have been with the client for so many years. So, you know, we don't have a choice in that. But if we have to pick one, I got to be honest, we don't have an allegiance to any of the supplier. So they all have their, you know, first of all, they all tell us that they have their in-house design people and they don't need an architect. So it's kind of an odd, awkward working relationship. I would say, you know, this is not an endorsement and this is not a pay advertisement. I find that the people that we work with that we've bent over backward to help at least us, HJT, without prior commitment, without any payment or any type of compensation, is an organization out of Scranton, Pennsylvania called Benco. That is the only organization that we have found that we had personally experienced that they will go out of their way to make sure that they help on the project, even if they do not get to sell a piece of equipment.
That's interesting.
Okay. Because I find that, and this is from personal experience, we like, you know, I don't push and or advocate any of the organization. I try to treat them all equally the same. If we have a choice, or should I say, if the client don't have any allegiance to any of the organization, I find that when I call the big three that we know, are Patterson, Benco, and Shine. Shine are good people, and they have helped out on projects from time to time. Patterson, I have to say, Patterson who? Because I don't really know their rep's name. We never been blessed with a courtesy return phone call on any projects of any size for any equipment. I spoke to the head, the person in charge of the design department. Their attitude is that they do exactly what the architects do. They do not need an architect on their project. As far as I know, none of the supplier actually can seal the drawings that come out of their office. They're not registered architects nor engineers. Now, in the state of Texas, Jim is correct. A building that are less than 5,000 square feet does not require for an architect to be involved. However, it is required that the MEP engineer have to seal the drawing. I don't know if even if the state of Texas doesn't require a dentist to work on your mouth, I'm not sure that I would go down, to the local garage where I'll say cut the hair and have them do a root canal. I wouldn't. An architect is an investment onto your project for your for your project where you're going to spend $500,000 up to several million dollars. So why not have a person that's trained in the area of looking at everything that pertains to your building, to your site, and help you out rather than have supply company throw something together for you, or a contractor throw something together for you, because they're not, they only look at the bottom line is how much money can I make from this project, and when you after you're done, you go like, why is my door sounds hollow? Well, because there's nothing that's been specified that you need a solid core door. Okay, why is my wall, I can hear a conversation between the two ops? Well, because there's nothing on the drawing that say that you want that wall to be soundproof and that you are concerned about being tagged by HIPAA. Okay, so I look at it as an investment. But in terms of suppliers, I have been on several projects that we needed, it was very small, and we needed equipment information and things like that. And Benco came on board, helped out, and with the understanding that they, it was a government job, and they would have to bid for the job if they can, even that is, if they were invited, they can bid on a job. If not, they can't. But they helped out. There was no promises of, we can't even recommend them on the job. Okay, all we can do is tell them that it's a government job, so they're gonna have to bid for it, so they know. It's there's a job going on, and it's up to them to reach out to the people who's involved in the bidding process. I was grateful for them because they came through. The rest just kind of snubbed their nose at the project because it's just too small for them, or they're not interested because they can do everything in house. Overpromising under delivery often land in the lap of the at the owner once it goes under construction. Now, Jim did mention something about plan stamping. Often I have been private message a few times with the acquisition that we say this kind of stuff to scare the client. Actually, no. If you see smoke, there's got to be a fire. Okay, so it's more of a caution for you. I work very closely with our local building official, and I post a question to our building official as a scenario. What if what if this occur, what would happen? You say if a project is under construction and they discover that the drawing, the name of the architects on the project, he was not the one who designed and were responsible for the design and the work of that particular project, it is within their authority to shut down a project until that gets straightened out. Now, talk about a nightmare.
Okay? Wow.
That is within their authority to shut down a project until an architect that take on the project produce the document and take liability for it and resubmit it. So, no, it's not a scare tactic. It's here it is. If you're running down the road and you are not aware that at the end, you know, shortly 100 yards in front of you is a cliff, and somebody say, there's a cliff, you can either continue and head that way because you want to save a couple steps, or you can stop and reassess and check it out. All right, because the pitch that I hear a lot is, hey, a contractor would do this. He'll have his buddy stamp the drawing that the supply house had generated, and for a few hundred dollars, he'll stamp it and off you go. Well, first of all, the work's not done by an architectural firm or supervised by an architect, and it gets sealed by an architect who did not do the work. You figured out what is the potential problem could be. And if you happen to be the lucky one that pulled the short straw and the building official came on and realized plan stamping was the case, you don't have an architect because he will lose his license, the one who sealed the drawings, and you may have a project that will be sitting still for months until you get that resolved.
And actually, you bring up a point that's rather interesting. Most people may not understand it. You have no recourse. There is no liability insurance. That's another aspect that we really haven't talked about. But a licensed architect should have professional liability insurance that can be something that that provides protection for the dentist, for the client, so that if something were to go wrong in the design process, meaning the dentist, has someone to go to try to get some compensation and file a claim. If you have an equipment supplier create and their in-house people create your design and move forward with that, my first question would be is, okay, where's your professional liability insurance? And they don't have any, and they can't provide you any because they're not licensed. So it's kind of like going out unprotected. It's like, I guess I give it the analogy of walking down the street without life insurance. It's not the most advisable thing. You typically need life insurance. But, you know, if you want to take that gamble, I guess you can take that gamble. So in a nutshell, you pay for what you get. If it's going to be free, beware. Or if it's going to be inexpensive, beware. Because, again, good quality dentistry costs money, and good quality architecture and design costs some money. So with that, Han, we're getting on. Go ahead.
Jim, I think a lot of time it's almost like the fish and bait processes. For the life of me, I don't understand even in today's society where the term free becomes such a attraction. You're going to spend hundreds, if not a couple million dollars, on a project. And somebody say, well, I can design your building for you for free. And they go, gosh, if you do for me for free, why would I need an architect to do it for me? Because it costs me. Well, I've always asked this question, and I never received an honest answer about it. If the people who tells you that they're going to design your building for free, okay, will they do it if you don't buy the equipment from them? Please come give me a call. Let me know that the answer is yes. I'm waiting for it. Okay, because I have not heard a response for it. I have not. Okay.
Hasn't happened.
I have not. Now, in terms of the equipment, though, whether the owner have a supplier on board or not, I strongly recommend that they engage in a conversation with the supply, with the supplier, equipment supplier, as early on, so that way they can provide the necessary information for their team. The equipment people will help them with making sure that they have all the nuts and bolts on the equipment that they need or they're thinking about, so that way they're not out there trying to piecemeal their equipment from refurbisher and or Craigslist sellers. Okay, I'm not trying to bash the supplier, but they are an important part of the team. But in terms of whether they're the right people to design the project or not, we don't believe that they are the right people to do it.
Right. Well, with that, without a doubt, they are very valuable team members that need to be part of your core. And like Han had mentioned, specifically our local Benco rep in our area here in Northwestern Ohio is, he's just a super guy, super knowledgeable, and very cooperative to, he understands. He understands that there's the right place for the right kind of people. And also the most important part is that everybody working together can do it and do it in such a way that it will really provide for the needs for the dentist. And that's, he's got the right mindset. So with that, I want to bring out that next week, episode number 9, we're going to be talking about the builder, specifically who should and how should you go about the aspect of finding a builder, whether it's a renovation or whether it's a new build. So we're going to have an in-depth discussion about that. Also coming up on episode number 10, which I think is scheduled for October 23rd, we're going to talk about dentistry and how dentistry can be created to pay for your practice. Our hope is that we're going to be pay for your new practice. Our hope is that we'll be having an in-depth interview with Dr. Bill Hunsinger on that one as well. And then, again, our very special guest, Mike Montgomery, is going to be on episode number 11, which is we're going to talk about who do you talk with first, the contractor or the banker. Mike Montgomery is a senior loan officer for Live Oak Bank, so we'll have a great opportunity to pick his brain on all those little particulars when it comes to the banking industry and banking that's specifically focused at dentistry. They're a phenomenal organization, and I think everyone will learn a lot about that. With that, we've got a few minutes, Han, to talk about the hot topics on Dentaltown this week.
There is Jim, there's a saying that, in architecture, from time to time, we'll ask the question of why did he or she did that with the design? And the answer is because he or she can. We laugh about that, but sometimes it's not a really funny joke. In the discussion that I read and was involved in a little bit this week, a particular doctor purchased a building. Of course, who want to spend money that they can, who want to spend money if they don't have to? So the question was, can I run my plumbing up into the ceiling instead of the slab and run it under the slab? Most of us would go, no. There's a thing that inherent to this earth is called gravity. Our plumbing system works on the assist of gravity. There's an old saying too, and let me say this: bleep floats downhill. Okay, you cannot. Let me see there. If you have a basement and you have a toilet downstairs because you have to, yes, they make pumps to pump it up, and bringing it, you know, bring it up to the street level so you can get it connected to the sanitary line. But that's one that may also connect to a sink. But typically, draining a toilet or a sink goes to the lowest point. That usually goes into your slab and under. Even though, you know, the saving in it is that it costs you a few $1,000s to cut the slab and run the plumbing in and then patch it. It costs you more plumbing, more material costs, more labor, because now the plumber is working above the, you know, above the ceiling. And then it costs you in the equipment, the number of pumps for the number of fixtures that you have. By the time that you're done, yes, you can have it put up into your ceiling. I don't know why you would, but it will cost you more just to go the conventional way, cut the slab, put it in, cover it up, and move forward. It was an interesting discussion because you have individuals that say they have done it or they can. But the detail is it done in their office or done in their home? How much it cost, and was it legal? According to our mechanical engineer, they wouldn't recommend it. If you have a stack of piping that are full of stuff and the pump dies, guess where it's going to flow down to? That's pretty gross. All right. So I thought it was an interesting, for me, it was an entertaining discussion. But even if you can, always run your plumbing to the lowest point of the building so you can get to the sanitary line. It's already at the, you know, at the ground level, and get out of your building. Don't make life more complicated than what it is.
Well, yeah, sewage ejection pumps, which are apparatuses that gather up wastewater, sewage, whatever, and pump it up to an elevated level so that gravity then can take it from there on, were actually created for the civil site issue for out in the parking lot or the areas that are outside of the building, because you need to have access to them. They need to be maintained. They sometimes don't always function. So if they break down, you need to have a backup system to be able to have the sewage or wastewater collected. All of that is really impractical to try to put with inside the building itself. I mean, sure, there might be a scenario where the only way that you can get a sink or something like that in a particular location is that you'd have to put in a small sewage pump to be able to do that. But that's on a limited basis, on an item-by-item kind of thing, and you'd have to have total control over that. And definitely, I wouldn't recommend putting that on anything that has to do with sewage. I would, you know, even question it if it was just a sink, because like you were saying, Han, because if it fails, the sink
you're
is inoperable. The water can't get out of the sink. You have to have a second means of getting that water out of the sink, or you can't use that sink. And so you deal with the smells, you deal with just the issues of getting rid of that waste, and then getting in and having to fix that piece of equipment. And these things aren't cheap. They're very expensive, and they have to be maintained. So you have an ongoing maintenance issue. You have an ongoing upfront cost that when it fails, you've got to get another one, and you've got to get it immediately. So you're paying for expedited delivery to get it over there. And obviously, we always know these things break at the most inopportune time. So,
naturally.
You know, what's it do? You know, you get something that fails, and you've got a whole schedule, a full schedule for your whole office and it makes you have to shut the office down for a day, what's that cost? That cost an unbelievable amount of money that you've lost in revenue that, you know, you'll never get back. And if you would have just done it right in the first place, like Han talked about, gravity, deal with it, let it work. That's the old tried and true method. And I guess that's one advocate of, if you ever build a new building, put the thing on a crawl space as a minimum. You know, slab on grades are great if you're looking for retail centers. They're terrible if you're looking for a dental office because of all the stuff that has to go underneath them. So, yeah, I mean, they're a little cheaper up front. That crawl space will pay dividends down the road when you have to potentially move something or you want to add to something, and the ease of putting it in the first place. So, yeah,
Jim, we do have a project right now that, we have fixtures and stuff like that down in the basement level, and it need to get up to the, at the ground level to the main sanitary line. So we do have those pumped. But the biggest, the feature of going that route is you have to have some type of a containment vessels to hold the water, the sewage, in case so that the pump can suck it out. It's not it's not one of those things where the pump is. Well, it would be interesting if this put into applications where you turn on the faucet and the pump turn on and evacuate the water, and sewage out of the line immediately. You know, like your on-demand water heater.
They don't work that way. Okay. No, actually, it grows. Okay. They go to a containment vessel or a crock, as one would call them, but they're bigger than just a little crock. I mean, they could hold hundreds of gallons of waste sewage. So you have that cost and that expense of putting that wherever you're going to put it down there. And on that particular project you're talking about, the only reason why that was required is that the dentist needed to have a basement, must have, and the existing utility lines, meaning the existing sewer lines, were too high in elevation in relationship to the finished floor of the basement. So the only way to solve that problem is gravity won't do it. You have to put in one of those sewage ejection pumps with the crock containment vessel and be able to evacuate the waste from that lower level. The other thing about it, though, in that particular situation, if it fails, it won't shut his practice down because none of his crucial clinical spaces are part of that. Only that's a staff area only that's located in the bottom of the basement area. It won't shut his practice down when and if that thing were to ever take a hiccup and decide to die on him and they have to wait for a new facility to come
for
and fix.
For your information, Jim, for your information, that the pump that goes to that crock is $24,000.
Not cheap. Yeah. Not cheap. Yeah.
You can cut a lot of slabs.
Yeah, you can cut a lot of slabs and do it right in the first place, or at least put in a crawl space. Well, with that, we've reached our 60-minute time slot and didn't want to keep everybody too long. We're thankful for you listening. Hopefully it was educational. I know we've had a great we really do enjoy this opportunity to be able to help and at least, provide a knowledge base that maybe you don't have or you didn't really get a chance to even think about. Obviously, if you have any questions or would like to talk with myself or Han, you can get a hold of us through our website at www.hjtdesign.com, or call us direct on our toll-free number, 866-213-1268. And with that, we're going to look forward to seeing you next Tuesday, when we're going to talk about the builder. And would like to say thank you, and good evening, Han.
And thank you for tuning in. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.